Tonight is lesson 11. We are, as I said, almost done. This is lesson 11. Next week is lesson 12. Both are on the topic of faith. So we'll be finishing up C.S. Lewis and then changing gears in November. And I'll have some announcements coming up on kind of what the November, December plan will be. We won't start another major long-term class until after the first of the year, but we do have midweek plans in November and December. So we just kind of keep it a little loose in those months because no one's where we think they are anyway. Everyone's traveling and doing stuff. So last thing you need is one more thing. Faith is the third of the three Christian virtues he's going to cover. He did them backwards because why not? He did love first and then hope last week. And then he actually gives two lessons to the topic of faith. He's a Christian apologist. So for him, believing and having faith is the end goal. That's the big one for him. It's not that he would say any of the others are less important. It's just he's clearly going to be focused on the idea of faith and have a lot to say about it. So whereas the lesson on hope was a little bit short, I thought, he does two on faith. And in fact, when I got to the end of this one, I didn't let myself read the next chapter again. I thought I'll just wait till next week and not confuse them. But I felt like it was kind of a cliffhanger. I remember he's going somewhere with it, but he gets somewhere and he says, well, okay, enough of that. And then next week he picks it up and keeps going. So we'll get some of it tonight. Faith, from the biblical point of view, it's not hard to convince yourself that faith matters and is of the utmost importance. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. Whoever would draw near to God must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who seek Him. Hebrews 11 and verse 6. Faith is absolutely essential to Christian life. It's absolutely essential to however we might define Christian salvation. I mean, whatever it is we're doing, if it doesn't have faith in it, I don't know what it is. Faith is who we are in a large way. However, it is notoriously difficult to define and really easy to poorly define. We use faith and belief in the New Testament are the same. There's, in English, I remember someone asking me, what's the difference between having faith in something and believing something? And I used to really fret about, what's the difference? Well, in the New Testament, none. There's zero. It's just sometimes in English it's smoother to say believe. Believe makes for a better verb. It's hard to faith something. So if you're doing it, the translator will say believe it. If you have it, they'll say faith or belief. If it's an adjective, like actually in Sunday morning sermon, this is a faithful saying, they'll say faithful because believeful doesn't sound very good, right? So in English, we have a couple different words, but in Greek, it's the same word over and over and over again. And it's the verb is pistuo, and it's a little tricky for us to get our head around what might be meant by it, even though it's clearly absolutely essential. So Lewis starts out with, predictably, there's more than one definition of faith, and one of them is going to be more helpful than the other. I'd go far as to say there's quite a lot more definitions of faith, but two that we're going to talk about. The first one is accepting or regarding as true the doctrines of Christianity. Of course, you could pick that up and move it into Buddhism or Hinduism or accepting as true. This is probably the most common use of the word faith and also the least important in some ways. It is important to accept as true things that are true just because they're true, so you should. But more often than not, this is not what the New Testament is talking about. This is kind of an intellectual activity, right? 2 + 2 = 4. You believe that to be true? Yeah, okay. Great, congrats, you have faith in arithmetic. Didn't require a lot of character on your part to summon up your ability to believe in, to summon up your ability to believe in that reasonable expression, 2 plus 2 equals 4. In fact, it would take a lot for me to talk you out of it. Pretty simple. Okay. So Lewis says this is the most basic way we use it and probably not the most useful. In fact, he used to think and ask, why do we even celebrate faith as a virtue? He says, I used to ask how on earth it can be a virtue. What is there moral or immoral about believing or not believing a set of statements? If you say 2 plus 2 does not equal 4, I'm going to say you're wrong, but you're not immoral. You're just, I don't know, bad at math, I guess, or maybe sanity. There's something not working in your head, but it's not a moral problem per se. It's not that you're suddenly lazy or dishonest. It's just you apparently don't know what 2 plus 2 equals. I'm feeling sorry for you. So Lewis says, you know, what's kind of weird? Why do we attach, and why does the Bible attach moral value to it? We say it's a virtue to have it, and even that you can have more or less of it. Okay, think about that for a second. You can have, O ye of little faith, or I have not seen such great faith in all of Israel. Okay, how can you have more or less acceptance? Let's go back to math. 2 plus 2 equals 4. How much do you believe that? Does anyone here have a little faith in that? Anyone here have a lot of faith in that? It's kind of a binary. Either you buy it or you don't. There's not a lot of, I'm about 75%, which would be funny because that's also math. I'm about 75% that 2 plus 2 equals 4. I'm about 75% convinced that 75 and 25 equal 101. No, that doesn't work. You get my point. Like it would be kind of silly to give degrees of certainty to things like math in that way. And yet we do it with faith. That's a really faithful person. That person, his faith is really struggling right now. What does that mean? So Lewis says, that tells me there's something wrong with the way we're talking about faith. He says, first of all, I was assuming that the human mind is completely ruled by reason. That is not so. If you decided what you believed entirely based on reason and computation in your brain, then yeah, there wouldn't be anything moral about it. Which is why the example I used was math, right? That one, when it comes to math, we're as reasonable as we're likely to get. 2 plus 2 equals 4. Anybody feel emotionally charged about that? Anyone's passions inflamed when I say 2 plus, anyone seem offended or, you know, hurt in some way, attacked by 2 plus 2? No, it's a completely neutral statement. You have no skin in the game. We don't care what the 2 plus 2. Now, you start talking about dollars, I might get unhappy. But as long as it's in the abstract, it is what it is. Nobody cares. We're completely reasonable. Most of the things you know and care about aren't actually that simple, are they? Cable news leads me to believe that most of the things we think we know, we have skin in the game of values, emotions, what I want to be true, what I'm willing to believe, what people that I believe are willing to believe. Like all of that factors into it, and it stops being just a 2 plus 2 equals 4 sentiment for all of us. That's I'm not saying one political party or one religion does it this way and the other doesn't. Everybody in every system, everywhere, all the time, knowing things is complicated. It's always more than just, here it is. And I think that's true. Once you get past 2 plus 2, everything else involves more of you than just your brain. You're not just a computation machine. You're not a computer. You're not a calculator. Instead, you factor all kinds of things in. So, Odie and I went out to lunch one time. He says, hey, meet me at Pigskins at noon. Now, in terms of sentence structure, that's pretty simple. Meet me at Pigskins at noon. Okay, 2 plus 2 equals 4. But think about all the things I factor into that. Do I think Odie's actually going to show up? Do I know him? Oh, I know him. I don't think he's lying to me. I've never had him play a practical joke on me where he told me to go somewhere and then he wasn't there and he laughed at me later. So I don't have any reason to think that. Do I have reason to think Odie might not be on time? Maybe a little, because, you know, I see when they pull into church. You know, I know. He's aware. So I mean, you think, okay. So if I get there at noon, 05, I'm probably okay. And think of all the things that, again, that you put into that knowledge that your brain is sorting out. There's no equation for it. You're just kind of working it out as you go. And that's, again, a simple thing like, hey, let's have lunch. We haven't had lunch in a while. We should do that again. See? I was really just hitting you up for barbecue right there. And so now think of something more complicated. Please no one answer this question, but I'm going to give you an example. Who won the last presidential election? A lot of people have a lot of skin in the game on that one. In a sense, everybody does. But ideology factors in, what you think is a credible amount of information, from what source. And we have great big, loud, angry, hostile debates over what in principle should have still been math, right? 2 + 2 = 4, 2 million plus 2 million votes. I mean, in theory, it's still math, but obviously it's more than math, or we wouldn't be arguing about it. Does that make sense? So what you're willing to believe has to do with more than that. We're not just about reason. And so the example he gives is learning to swim. Okay, you take a kid, take him down to the pool, and this one really works for me because I have a little phobia about drowning and am not crazy about anything that involves water I can't stand up in, which is a lot for me. I can go pretty deep before I really have to worry about it. But further than that, had bad swimming experiences, I'm not convinced. So, seems like there's a lot of ways to die there. You take a kid, and you put him in the pool, and he looks around. Are there, and this is morbid, but just go with me a minute, are there just dead, drowned bodies all the way across the pool everywhere he looks? No, he looks around, and people are splashing and swimming and floating, and almost no one is dying. As a general rule, you don't see any drownings at the pool, okay? I'm pretty cynical, but even I have to admit, yeah, I guess most people survive the event, okay? And he looks, and he knows it. And then his mother takes him and puts him in the pool and says, all right, I'm going to let go of you now, but you start to drown, I won't let you drown. Right? You start to go under, I'll grab you, come back up, but don't worry, you're not going to, it's going to be fine. Mom, let's go. And what does the kid do? His brain does not do 2 + 2 = 4. Like, all the evidence is there. He knows this should work. And the person I've trusted my entire life, every minute of every day, has told me I'll be safe. But I'm going to go ahead and grab on for dear life because I'm afraid. There is nothing in that has to do with reason. See, faith has this other quality to it. It has a lot to do with morality, about trustworthiness, about what you're willing to believe, and what are the consequences if you're wrong. You factor all of that in every time you get in your car, when you make a right turn at an intersection. I mean, every time you do anything, you're factoring all that in. So Lewis says, he's seen dozens of people float and swim. But the whole question is whether he'll be able to go on believing this when the instructor takes away his hand and leaves him unsupported. See, now belief means something different. You give him a physics test and you say, Ben, do people float pretty well? Yeah, I know how it works. Put me in water, don't believe it anymore. People sink. People like me sink a lot. Not 2 + 2 anymore, it's not reason. So this word believing now takes on a quality that's almost moral in nature. Are you willing to trust something that you thought was true a minute ago? So, to make it biblical, you don't have to swim, but you could walk on water and get the same story, couldn't you? Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. And he said, come. So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. Stop there. What evidence is available? Let's be scientists for a minute. I know Archimedes' principle says he's supposed to sink, but there is a person currently walking on the water. I spoke to him. He said, come on out. And then I myself walked on the water. 2 + 2 = 4. Apparently we're doing okay. I don't know how it works, but it is. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, Lord, save me. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying, Oh, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? Like, you knew the answer a minute ago. The circumstance changed, and you no longer believed the same knowledge. Something changed. And that difference, he says, is faith. The ability to believe something when your circumstance changes is faith. So, the new definition then that Lewis wants to give us, a second definition, is faith is continued trust in what is known. If I were the grand poopah of all Bible translators on the planet, and all the Christians did what I said, when we come to the New Testament and translate the Bible, I would just take out the word faith entirely and belief, and I would just put in the word trust as my English translation, because I think it actually conveys better. Without trust, it is impossible to please him. He that comes to God must trust that he is, and that he's a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. That sounds like the right word to me. You of little trust. How often trust is actually the word that's really intended in most of those sentences. So in my mind, that's the word I would want. But Lewis goes further and says it's continued trust. The ability to believe something is true even when something changes. Or he says it much better. Faith is the art of holding on to things your reason has once accepted in spite of your changing moods. You believed it once. Faith is, and I still do, even when the weather changes. That's his definition of faith, which I think is pretty spectacular. Does it match up with Scripture? Hebrews 11 again, verse 1. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. I think Lewis's definition could lay on that pretty well. You could say it's this conviction that I have, even as circumstances might change, or my life changes, there is something that is hoped for, and I continue to believe that it's true. That's faith. My definition works too, by the way. Now, trust is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. You either trust that they're there or they're not. Something like that works out, I think. Another place where I think this is a good example, you believe that God is one, you do well, even the demons believe and shudder. In this case, this verse is using the first definition of faith, isn't it? You accept that there is one God. Very good. So do demons. Right? Do demons act like it? No. And that's the difference. So I think Lewis would say this is the first use of the word faith. But what the Bible actually asks of you is that second definition, that real trust and action. Okay, so now we get back finally to our virtue chart. We need some words. If faith/trust is the name of virtue, what would be the vice of having no trust/faith whatsoever? What would we call that? Person who has no trust. Cynical? Huh? Faithless? Cheater. Untrusting? Yeah. Any other words come to mind? No trust whatsoever. Skeptical. Okay. I was thinking, after I made the slide, I thought, you get a gold star, because skeptical is the one that I used. Yeah, you get a point. But after I made the slide, I was thinking another interesting word would be, if you want to take trust, paranoid. Right? A person who constantly believes everyone's lying and no one is trustworthy. On a personal level, we call that paranoid. Okay. But skepticism. I'm actually glad no one put doubt over there, because you could have. I'm going to talk about doubt in just a minute. It's a cousin, but I don't think it's the same thing. We'll talk about doubt. But skepticism is like just radical disbelief and distrust. Okay. The example, I'll steal my point that I'm going to use later, which I stole from Tim Keller, so it's okay. Here's the difference between doubt and skepticism. Every so often, I lose my car keys. Okay? Happens on a regular basis. Celine usually finds them. Okay? So I lose them. Okay? And then what happens when you lose your car keys? You look in your pants pocket, you look in the drawer where you put things, you look in the funny place you thought you might have put it but didn't. You look in all the places that you thought it was going to be, and you don't find it. Okay. Doubt is that sinking sensation that something's not where you left it. And you start to question your own sanity, right? This is strange. Skepticism is when you decide, based on that feeling, I don't think I ever owned any card keys. I'm not sure there's such a thing as cars. Right? Skepticism is that one step further where you take doubt and just say, I now disbelieve everything I have known up till now because of the sinking sensation of doubt. Doubt is something we all encounter. We don't have to be skeptics. You can have confidence in something even while you're wrestling with a set of doubts. I still believe my car keys exist, even though my current experience makes me question that. Right? I think the car in my driveway will operate. I can find those keys, you see. And then you find them in the freezer or something where you put them down, or in a toolbox, and you think, how did that happen? What's too much faith? Willful blindness. Gullibility. So again, if you say faith, it's hard to say what's too much faith. Well, I can't have too much faith. That sounds good. But if you say trust, what's too much trust? You start to think, yeah, we have some words for that. And I went with gullibility, actually. But I like, you know, blind acceptance of anything anybody tells you. Right? The person, you can pull one over on them. You just tell them and they, oh, really? Wow, you trust me a little bit too much. That's scary. Quit that. Okay. So I think that would be how we'd think about this. And when you see it that way, again, with trust in the middle, you start to understand it. There is an appropriate kind of trust you're supposed to have in other people and in God. You cannot function as a human either like this, with zero trust, or with 300% trust. You have to sometimes believe somebody, and you have to be able to know the difference to be a human, to function in any way. And to be a Christian, we just take that one step further. God is a person, and you're going to have to be able to navigate through that. Is he trustworthy or not? Can you believe that he is and that he cares about those that seek him? That's the Hebrews 11:6 standard of trust. So Lewis continues. Back to this mood thing. He said, unless you teach your moods where to get off, you can never be either a sound Christian or even a sound atheist, but just a creature dithering to and fro with its beliefs really dependent on the weather and the state of its digestion. He points out, he says, when I was... faithlessness is not just a problem for Christians. He says, when I was an atheist, there were moments where I doubted atheism. And I thought, what if Christianity's true? Like, I had to, as an atheist, learn to have faith in my atheistic convictions. And now that I'm a Christian, I have to practice faith in my Christian convictions. That is, if you have zero trust in anything, if literally every morning you wake up and start over, every day is fresh, I don't believe anything, I don't know anything this morning until I prove it again today, you're in for a rough morning. Right? I don't know. That outlet provided electricity for my toaster yesterday. I don't know anymore. I've got to call an electrician, got to test it. Eventually you say, okay, pretty sure it works, I'm going to make toast, move on with my day. If you just can't trust anything at all, that kind of skepticism, you just can't function. So he says, because it's moral in nature, faith is something you have to train. I see the difference. If it's just accepting, you just get it or you don't. 2 + 2 = 4. Again, it's kind of binary. Either you buy it or you don't. I can't make you believe it more. I'm a real firm believer in arithmetic. It's either you do or you don't. Okay. But when faith is something more than that, if it's moral, if it's character-based, then you have to train that. You have to develop it like a muscle. And Lewis says, guess what things a person would need to do to develop faith? all the things Christians are told to be doing in the Bible. Right? The Christian regimen is do these things to stay faithful. You're going to recognize that your moods change. You're not going to be surprised by it. One day you're going to wake up and say, do I believe in God? And you're not going to know why. And it could be because someone you love died. It could be because your health took a bad turn. Lewis's point about digestion, it could have been something you ate. Your moods change. He says, as a Christian, you're just going to embrace that and say, yes, they do. But I'm going to practice faith. I'm going to practice daily prayer. Why? Because if every day I treat God as a real person I trust, it reinforces the fact that I trust Him. I'm going to read the Bible or Christian writings in some way. Why? Every day I reinforce the fact that I believe these things. I'm helping that muscle for the day when I don't feel as much like I do. I'm going to go to church. Why? Because I need somebody to remind me that I believe these things every so often, and that there's other people that believe it, and maybe we're not crazy. Or at least I'm not any crazier than you are. So you need that, and it develops that muscle. Especially for me, church going is a big one, because you can even, Ben's particular heresy, you can borrow other people's faith temporarily. In my mind, in a Sunday morning, I think there's this big pool of faith that everybody contributes to. And some days, I've got like 10 ounces, and Val has like 80 pounds. She throws in 80 pounds of faith, and I'm like, well, okay. On average, we're doing okay. And then some days, it's the other way around, right? And I'm a believer that day, and she's like, I'm just here. I think you borrow. I think you borrow from the pool. Everybody sings, great is thy faithfulness. Some of us meant it the first time. Some of us meant it the second time. Some of us will mean it next week. You just keep doing it, and it stretches that muscle, and you strengthen by what other people supply. Fun story. That sermon I preached Sunday about endurance, they let me give the chapel talk this morning to the Ukrainians, so I condensed 20 minutes to 10 minutes, and then condensed it to 5, because you have to have 5 for translating. And anyway, but I gave the 5-minute version of that, and as I was thinking about it, I thought, yeah, I really need to tell Ukrainian Christians about endurance. Maybe they should just come tell us about it. I don't know. Anyway, but they mentioned it because they said, I was really encouraging. You have no idea. You've been encouraging me and just being around people that believe. And so he says, we have to be continually reminded of what we believe. It must be fed. Just keep talking about it. Which is a funny thing. Again, I'm a Christian apologist. Atheists like to say, you know, you Christians just you brainwash each other into what you believe. Can I tell you a secret? We're all brainwashing each other all the time. That's all anybody does. You know what an atheist does? He reads atheist books, and he listens to atheist podcasts, and he reads or watches atheist YouTubes, and goes to coffee with his atheist friends. And you know what he's doing? The exact same thing. He's trying to reinforce what he's decided he believes. So yeah, I am, every Sunday morning, I try to brainwash you a little. The difference is I tell you I'm doing it. Like, you're here voluntarily. I'm going to try to convince you one more time for 7 more days that God is real and His Son died on the cross and was raised the 3rd day and you should go do something about it. I'm trying to brainwash my kids too. Like, unapologetically. Everybody else is trying to brainwash my kids. I ought to get a shot at it. Right? So I'm trying. Like, every day I'm trying to brainwash them just a little more than the other guy. And if they get 51% of my brainwashing and 49% of the other guy's, then I feel like, well, won that day by a little. yeah, of course we're all trying to persuade each other all the time and reinforce our beliefs. Of course we are. That's what we all do. Stop being surprised by it. We're not calculators. We're humans. And that's how we work. And I'm glad. He says, in fact, maybe we ought to realize that's how it always works. He says, if you examined 100 people who had lost their faith in Christianity, I wonder how many of them would turn out to have been reasoned out of it by honest argument. Do not most people simply drift away? Now, I'll say in my experience, when people kind of leave the faith, quite often they find a reason afterward. And so when it's all over, they'll say, well, The thing that really shook my faith was, and they'll tell me about something that happened in that process that really was like intellectually challenging. But more often than not, I'm not going to say universally, more often than not, it was a process that began with a change in behavior. There was more that led up to it. Circumstance changed, friends changed, behavior changed. And then I found a reason to think differently afterwards. And I think Lewis's point is correct, that people, it's very rare that people walk out at the front door of a church, meet an atheist who says something they had never thought of before, and they just throw up their hands and say, "Oh, that was, I never thought of that, I don't believe in God anymore." And the same way the other direction. I'm a Christian apologist, I'm in the persuasion business, I've not yet met an atheist that I gave like the perfect Christian argument to and they said, well, I haven't ever thought of that, I guess I'm a Christian now. It's always a process. Like you change your mind over time because it has to do with behavior, has to do with emotions. You got skin in the game. And that's how all these things develop. And that's why we call it, it's more than just accepting an idea. The word faith is really the right word for it. It's about trust. At this point, he changes gears a little bit, and I'll admit to you, I got lost and had to reread this section twice. Because he's setting up the next chapter, and I felt like we changed gears. But I think I can kind of summarize what he's trying to say. He's trying to get you to think of faith in a little bit higher realm than just accepting an idea. So he reminds you that back when we talked about humility, he says the first thing you got to know about humility is you're not. First thing you got to know about humility is you're proud. He says it's kind of the same way with faith. You got to start out by recognizing your faith is not, again, just a block commodity that I can hand to you and you put it on the shelf and it's there. Again, I talk to a lot of people as a minister about faith, and it's interesting to me how often someone will say, I haven't been to church in a while. My faith is fine. My faith has never been stronger. And what they're trying to tell me is it's okay. I don't have a problem. It's just I'm not doing those other things. And when I hear that, again, I try not to be judgy. I'm assuming you're not lying to me. But Lewis's point is it's kind of like when a person says, I don't have a problem with humility. I've got all the humility I need. It's that other stuff. You know, it's like, well, maybe that's more the problem than you know. So he'll say, no man knows how bad he is till he has tried very hard to be good. He says, when you really take your faith seriously for a minute and like try to legitimately live out your faith, you say, wow, I'm not very faithful at all. And you get it. There's more to it. And that's what I think I was trying to say a minute ago when someone's in my office and says, I don't participate in church, I don't do any things Christians do, but my faith is strong. I'm like, wow. You're not really trying to see that, are you? You're doing none of the things that would exhibit trust so that you don't have to know whether you trust or not. Yeah, of course I do. Or as Lewis will say, faith is strengthened when we begin to wrestle with our doubt. To use his military metaphor, after all, you find out the strength of the German army by fighting against it, not by giving in. You find out the strength of a wind by trying to walk against it, not by lying down. My mentor and hero in Christian apologetics was Dr. Baird, and in my first apologetics class with him at OC, he said, people get into, and this, he says, this is a confession just for people in the apologetics program, so now I'm sharing it with the world. He says, people get into Christian apologetics because they have doubts about Christianity. Like you start out and you have questions and you want answers, and so you start collecting all the possible answers. Says, so if people don't get into Christian apologetics because they think they know it all. Like more often than not, it's because, I got questions. What's the answer to that one? And then suddenly you're a guy who accidentally became an expert in answering those questions because you had them all. And I think it's true. Like the people that seem to be the most convicted, like legitimate conviction, not gullibility, but legitimate conviction, they are people that have never thought about their faith. People who thought about it really hard and suffered some stuff and went through some things and said, well, it was tough. Right? That's where faith is developed. Faith is developed in adversity, not just intellectually, but in adversity. Tim Keller has a wonderful book on prayer. And in the introduction, he says, you know, I was a Presbyterian pastor for years and years and years. He said, then I developed cancer. And it went from, I think I should pray, to I have to pray to live. Like, I'm not going to survive this spiritually or mentally or physically if I don't become a person of prayer. And it was at that point in his life he started writing about prayer. And it's a magnificent book for that reason. But it was adversity. He'd been to seminary. He knew why you're supposed to pray. It was adversity that instilled in him the necessity of it in his own personal life. So again, I think faith is something that's going to be strengthened by challenges. Don't avoid them. You don't have to put your faith in peril every day. But when we face obstacles, faith becomes stronger. Faith in the higher sense will begin when we develop a better knowledge of who we are before God. Okay. I said faith is trust early on. How does trust work? How do you develop trust in a person? You get that by getting to know that person better and how you relate to them. So if you say, I trust a person completely, I'm assuming you know that person really well. I say that about my wife. I don't say that about complete strangers. I would never say about a complete stranger, I trust that person completely. Trust him with my life. No, you don't. You don't even know that guy. Trust comes with personal knowledge. And again, personal knowledge is not even intellectual. I don't know exactly how tall Celine is. I could guess. Like, there's some statistics intellectually that I might not know about her. But I know how many cartons of Christmas-flavored ice cream are currently in the refrigerator. I know it's her favorite, and I know she's going back for more. Like, I know the personal things about her, and will expose it. Like, I will shame her. No, I'm saying that because it's too many, and she doesn't share. But anyway, point is, yeah, not sharing now. Yeah. Personal knowledge, it's a whole different flavor of knowledge than 2 plus 2 equals 4. And yet personal knowledge is where trust comes from. So, knowing who you are before God allows for faith. It has to be a personal, I know it's cliche, it has to be a personal relationship. You have to relate to him as you would to a person because he is a person and so are you. And that's where the faith and trust are going to develop. So, he says there's two discoveries for faith that are necessary if you want to get this higher sense. Again, of knowing something about God that makes him trustworthy. Number one, yes, he is a judge, but not a judge like he's giving you an exam. He says, if that's who you think God is, that he is the great exam giver in the sky, you'll never trust him. How come? Because we'll all fail. The main thing we learn from a serious attempt to practice Christian virtues is that we fail. If there was any idea that God has set us a sort of exam, that has to be wiped out. If you think God is out there with the red marker ready to mark your answers wrong and check them off and give you a grade and send you to whichever place you deserve, if that's your view of God, you can't trust him. He's out to get you. You'll never develop faith if that's your view of God. You don't know the right person yet. Second, he says, God is, yeah, he's a judge, but he's not a judge in the sense of one to barter with. We have nothing to offer. This isn't a judge like a guy in the market who's determining how much grain is worth. It's not that kind of judge. Because you have nothing to give. If your plan is, yeah, I know God, he's great, and I think if I live a good life, he'll really like me. If that's your plan, again, you don't know God, and you can't trust that person. Why? What you're saying is, I think God will like me if I do really good stuff and give him really good things, and it turns out you're not a really good person, and you have nothing to give. Right? If you devoted every moment of your whole life exclusively to his service, you could not give him anything that was not, in a sense, his own already. So if this is about bartering, that's how you know him. Can't develop faith or trust with that person because you're knowing the wrong person. He uses the great example, even offering God our faith is like when my kids say, hey, Dad, I really want to go get Christmas presents this year. It's like, great. Who's paying for it? Well, you are, Dad. Great. I take them to the store, and I give them money to buy me a present. Anything you give to God is about like that. I'm sure he appreciates the sentiment, but you're not giving him anything, including faith. Like, you couldn't even know and believe in him if he didn't make that possible. Anything you have by way of character comes from him. Anything good comes from him. We give thee but thine own, as the old hymn says. We give thee but thine own. So, what Lewis says, and he ends with a cliffhanger, is to say, faith is trust. Trust comes from personal knowledge. We have to make sure we're getting to know the right person. This is not him. When you learn who he is, then we can start to talk about what faith in him actually looks like. And he ends with these great sentences. When a man has made these two discoveries, God can really get to work. He doesn't even say, when you figured that out, now you can get started. He says, no, now God can work on you. It is after this that real life begins. The man is awake now. We can now go on to talk of faith in the second sense. And the chapter ends. Like, what? No, I want more. He says, but no, this is the groundwork. We can't even talk about trusting God the way we should until we get rid of the bad ideas of who God is and get to know who this person actually is and how he relates to us. Okay. That's my thoughts. How about some discussion questions? You may have lots of them. Here's a couple from me. How does faith relate to accepting right doctrine? That's how we usually use it. Lewis kind of poo-pooed that a little bit and said that's not the biggest kind of faith, and I think he's right. Does that mean it has no relation whatsoever to being right about anything? I mean, what's the connection? How do we want to spell that out? If faith is a virtue, is doubt a vice? I gave you my sales pitch on doubt and skepticism and the difference. But it's become really trendy in Christian books in the last couple of decades to talk about, like, the virtue of doubt. Like, you need to have doubts and struggle with doubt. It's like, well, I'm not saying I'm, like, in favor of them. I'm saying you're going to have them. So when you have them, let's meet them head on and let's talk about it and be honest. Don't lie about your doubts. I'm not sure I'm ready to say doubt's a really good thing. Sounds like something the devil does. I don't know. Anyway, I'm curious, when you hear the word doubt, what do you think of and how do you experience doubt? And then, just because I'm a guy who is interested in this field of stuff, how does faith relate to the various ways in which we know things? Can you have faith in math? Can you have faith in science? Can you have faith, or are those completely opposite? If you listen to a scientist talk, they say, well, I don't have faith, I have science, and I know these things. Like, they're complete opposites. Based on what Lewis said, it seems like those words don't even mean the same thing anymore. Now I'd have to have faith in science, or else I guess I wouldn't believe it. Like, do I trust my method? Do I trust my experiment? Do I trust that guy's reporting? But it's a good set of questions. Does it change the way, even personal experience? Do you have faith in your own experience? My experience lies to me sometimes. Like where I left my keys. What do I know? Okay, those are questions that I thought of at the end, but I didn't have nearly as many questions at the end of this chapter as some of the others because he was in my wheelhouse of things I'm interested in. So I'm curious, what do you think about faith from this section and what's your takeaways?